Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Got a lot of movies this week for you to choose from this weekend. And joined by film critics Charles Solomon, Peter Rayner, and Claudia Puig. We begin with the action flick Rampage, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Naomi Harris. Brad Peyton is the director. Four credited screenwriters. Claudia, what'd you think?
Well, if it wasn't for Dwayne Johnson, I would probably have really disliked this movie, but he's so charming, and it's kind of hard to dislike him. He has a really nice chemistry with this. Let's see, he was a silverback gorilla who was also albino and played by a person like an Andy Serkis.
It's a motion capture.
And the best scenes are between the two of them, and they're sort of little funny isms. And if you ever wanted to see a gorilla flip off Dwayne Johnson, here's your big chance.
There's a quote line.
That'll be on the poster.
For a movie about a video game, it was moderately entertaining. That last, inspired by video game. The end just went on way too long. It was way protracted. But Dwayne Johnson is so charming.
He really is very watchable and fun but it's funny because he's playing a character who. He's this primatologist who has bonded with this silverback gorilla named George in the San Diego game preserve.
Yeah.
And George is like his best friend, and he communicates with sign language. Sign language is real big this lately with A Quiet Place, also a lot of sign language.
Yeah.
But what's funny is that he's playing a character who has trouble communicating with humans. He feels more of an affinity with animals. But it doesn't really work for Dwayne Johnson because he's so extroverted and such a people person.
Yeah, yeah.
That, it doesn't quite work. But then, he's not meant to really be much of an actor anyway. But in a way, he sort of is for what he does.
His comic timing is always right on.
Yeah, he has some very funny lines.
Moments. You buy him as a primatologist.
You don't not buy him. The other characters are sort of there's a villain played by Malin Ackerman that's kind of Cruella de Vil, very simple. And then there's Jeffrey Dean Morgan who plays what seems to be a villain, but he plays it scenery chewing Southern accent. They're having fun with it.
Yeah, so the premise is there's this genetic experiment gone awry. So George becomes, instead of this really friendly gorilla, becomes this huge monster, and then he's teamed
King
up
Kong.
with this lizard, reptile,
wolf. Oh, yeah,
well, there's a wolf.
Crocodile.
There's two others:
wolf,
lizard, crocodile, and a wolf, who are all on this rampage. Chicago.
I kept thinking, why didn't it crash into like a house and make a person big? It had to go to the animals.
One question I had, we've had a number of films where Dwayne Johnson has really surpassed the movie that he's in.
Yes.
And what are examples of what you think have been really where the movie's been as good as he is in it?
That's a really good question because I think he almost always surpasses it. Like San Andreas was another one and was the same director for this one.
Right.
It's kind of like you're saying he's been underutilized consistently.
Yes. I'd say, what was the animated movie?
Was he in Baywatch?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, that was not good on any level.
No.
I think the thing with him is that, he was a wrestler for so many years. And,
which requires acting.
Yeah, I mean, it's all acting, really.
It's not real?
So there's so much of what they do in the ring. They have to play a villain or, you got to get audiences to love you or hate you. It's all a lot of fun in a way, and it's acting. So it's not that much of a transition to what he's doing in these films. I hope the day does not come when we see him play Hamlet just to show that he can act, sometimes.
Well, he may run for president.
He just needs to make better movies of the kind of movies that he makes. I think.
Yeah.
Rampage is the film we're talking about, starring Dwayne Johnson and Naomi Harris. Brad Peyton directed. It's rated PG-13, and it's rampaging in theaters everywhere. Borg versus McEnroe, a biopic that takes us back to the great rivalry of Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe on the tennis courts. Janis Metz is the director. Ronnie Sandahl is the screenwriter. Peter, what'd you think of Borg versus McEnroe?
I think it's not bad, mainly because of the McEnroe part, but it really should be, Borg with a little bit of McEnroe as opposed to versus McEnroe. Shia LaBeouf is...
he pronounces it LaBeouf.
He would.
It's the American.
What does
he
know? it's no secret that he has this sort of bad boy outlaw persona
which
made off the
inspired
screen.
Casting, I thought,
which works very well in this movie, yes. Obviously as yeah. as McEnroe. The Bjorn Björk character is the premise of the film is that we think that Björk is this very controlled, icy guy, and then you know, and he meets his polar opposite in this, you know, match of the century. But what the film demonstrates is that Björk was more like McEnroe as a young man than McEnroe was. That he was unruly and had to be sort of, you know, tamped down. And
when he was quite young,
when he was quite young, by his coach, played
so that's why he's so contained. Is he had to do that?
He learned to do it because he himself was not unlike him.
Yeah, you know, and Stellan Skarsgård, who plays his coach and mentor and father figure, is the one who sort of puts him in line. I think he makes the switch over a little bit too soon, that you don't really see the transition. It's like he's this crazy kid, and then all of a sudden he's like this, you know, ice pick.
That's a good point. They don't show the process of it. But I really like this movie. I thought that the actor who played the grown Björk, and they have the son of actually
yeah, the
Björn
actual
Björk
son of
playing
Björk
him
plays
as a
young Björk.
Yeah,
really?
Björk, which was really yeah. smart. Sverrir, I'm going to mutilate this name, Sverrir Gunnarsson plays Björk.
Looks a lot like
he
looks
very
one.
Much like him. I actually saw him in 1975 at the French Open, way back.
And, and this fooled you, so that's good. Right?
And you didn't see him at Studio 54? No,
unfortunately, I never went there. Darn it. But I thought LaBeouf was maybe the best thing about the movie, but I also thought that Gunnarsson was really good, or Gunnarsson. And I liked the fact that they were, you know, it kind of showed that they were more similar. They ended up being lifelong friends. I thought it was an interesting way of approaching it.
I think it overdoes a little bit the Swedish. I mean, in the beginning, I thought it was almost like an Ingmar Bergman movie because Borg is standing on a balcony in Monaco, you know, sort of revving for this big match.
Right.
And he's sort of almost thinking of jumping over the balcony.
Or you think he is, yeah.
Yeah, you think he's going to jump over the balcony, and it's like, it's a little too Swedish.
All these images when he says, like, Ingmar Bergman come into mind on the tennis court.
Yeah, you know, Finney and Alexander and Bjorn.
Yeah. Tennis was...
Yeah, death puts down a chessboard and picks up a tennis racket.
Also, you find, you do get a certain amount of sympathy for McEnroe because the way he's depicted in the movie, you know, his parents are pretty rough on him.
Yes.
His mother chides him for only scoring a 96 on an exam, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes.
So that's the sort of Freudian 1A explanation.
I like
McEnroe.
The fact that it was originally billed as kind of a battle between opposites, and we find out they're not really opposites. So that was kind of it's kind of a simple thing, but I thought it was well done.
Yeah.
And I like Skarsgård, too.
Yeah, it'll soon be on a double bill with Battle of the Sexes.
Exactly.
The challenge has got to be in the McEnroe portrayal, though. McEnroe is such a complex figure. Very intelligent, very analytical.
Great sports analyst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a great tennis analyst. But on the other hand, someone who's so subject to his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And you always wonder how much of that was gamesmanship, how much of that was lack of self-control. There's all these kinds of, you know, gray areas.
Well, they deal with that in the movie.
They
like
do.
There's a, you know, they show that he won't even have lunch with his fellow tennis players, including good friends of his. Because he doesn't want to get too close to anybody. You know, he just sort of removes himself from everything. When he's in the hotel where he's holed up, he writes on the wall, you know, a sort of a flow chart of how he's going to beat Borg. And it's, you know, he's obsessed. And I think that's all taken from real documentation.
And it's also really interesting on the meta level because you have Shia LaBeouf, who doesn't seem to be able to control himself, playing this guy who can't control himself, but is controlling himself enough to play that. So I thought it was really intriguing.
Heavy.
I'm curious, do they also capture, though, these athletes' physical style of play and movement?
Yeah,
very
which
much
is
so.
Done very well.
Details,
the final matches, you wouldn't know it's not real.
The film is Borg versus McEnroe in wide release. Janos Metz is the director. Ronnie Sandahl is the screenwriter. It's rated R, and it stars Sverrir Gunnarsson and Shia LaBeouf. Also out this week, the drama Beirut, starring John Hamm and Rosamund Pike. Brad Anderson directed from Tony Gilroy's screenplay. It's rated R. Peter.
Well, this is John Hamm's latest attempt to be a movie star and not just a TV star, and he's quite good in it. I think the film is not bad. He plays a sort of, you know, U.S. Diplomat in Beirut. It starts out in 1972, and he's sort of the life of the party. He schmoozes with everybody, with the Americans, with the Israelis, with the PLO, with the Muslims, with the Lebanese Christians. You know, he's just, everybody
he's
loves
married
him.
Married to a Lebanese woman.
Married to a Lebanese woman. And he's sort of quasi-adopted a 13-year-old Lebanese boy.
Yeah.
And so the party scene in the beginning shows him at his peak of, schmoozing peak. And then all hell breaks loose and tragedy happens. And then it cuts to 10 years later in 1982. And now he's sort of an alcoholic, a labor mediator in Boston. But he's called back to Beirut.
One last job
because a CIA buddy of his has been kidnapped, an American. And so he's supposed to sort of negotiate the guy's freedom. And it's very intricate. Tony Gilroy has written a lot of the Bourne movies. He wrote and directed Michael Clayton. And he's very good at sort of laying all this kind of political intrigue stuff out. And Ham, I think, is quite believable, both as the party animal and as the down and outer.
I think
reminded me a little bit of sort of Paul Newman in The Verdict kind of thing.
Yes, very much. I think it's Ham's best role since Mad Men. Gilroy really, it's kind of he's the perfect writer for someone like John Ham because he likes. He's does these handsome men forced into these morally gray areas. You saw George Clooney, Michael Clayton, Clive Owen in Duplicity, Matt Damon in the Bourne movie. So, it's kind of in that same vein. And I thought it worked really well.
Yeah, it was written in the 1990s originally. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that was going on then is still going on now. So there's a certain topicality to it, almost by accident. But he's very good at playing flawed heroes.
He is.
And that works here.
And he physically takes on the role. I mean, he becomes an alcoholic and he looks
He looks a little,
worse for wear.
Down. Yeah. I would just recommend, as long as we're on John Hamm, Marjorie Prime was a wonderful, very neglected small movie last year that he was in.
Yes, with
Lois
Smith.
Performance.
We should have gotten the Best Supporting Actress nomination.
Yeah, and Gina Davis, who was quite remarkable in it as well.
Yes.
We're talking about the movie Beirut, starring John Hamm and Rosamund Pike. Brad Anderson directs. It's rated R in selected theaters. Next film is Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. It stars Lucy Hale, Tyler Posey, and Sophia Ali. Jeff Wadlow is the director, and there are four credited screenwriters, including Wadlow. Peter?
Yeah, well, not to be confused with Madonna's Truth or Dare.
Go back and
Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. It's not to be confused with a good movie either. Basically, eight college friends go to Mexico, Rosarito, and they sort of, get drunk and hook up and do all the things that you do there during break. And then they are lured into a mysterious cave by a guy that they meet at the bar. And it turns out that they've all been dragooned into this truth or dare game, which is a part of some evil spirit that is possessing all of them. And they must play the game. When they go back to college, it turns out the game follows them. And so, someone opens up their textbook and they'll see a note saying truth or dare. It's silly, but without being sort of silly fun. It's just kind of dumb, dumb, not fun. And the actors are all not terribly good and fairly interchangeable. And given the gravity of what's going on, because, if you don't play the truth or dare game, then you're supposed to die. But bad things happen. But bad things happen anyway. So there doesn't seem to be any way out. But the two, girls in the film who are best friends, they keep having fights with each other because, your boyfriend's been, she's been fooling around and this and that. And, the one thing, there was one of the eight characters is an Asian guy who is gay. And his truth is he has to tell his father, who's a very, homophobic cop, that he's gay. He has to come out to his father. So after he does it, he says, "Gee, I feel better now." So you say, "Well, wait a minute. Where's the bad part of this?"
And they did that off camera. That should have been the big scene.
Yeah, it's really and some of the way it wraps up involves a fake Facebook account. I have to add, which is curiously appropriate.
Ripped
from the headlines. Yeah. Right.
We're talking about Blumhouse's Truth or Dare, a horror film that's in wide release this week from Jeff Wadlow. It's rated PG-13. Coming up, the animated feature Sergeant Stubby, an American Hero, also the romantic drama Submergence, and the dramatic thriller An Ordinary Man with Ben Kingsley. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back with more movies in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us, whether you listen live Fridays at 11 or Saturdays at noon on 89.3. Joined this week by critics Peter Rayner, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. Next up, the animated feature Sergeant Stubby, an American Hero. It's directed by Richard Lonnie, who co-wrote it with Mike Stokey II. Charles?
Well, as computers have gotten cheaper and faster and software has gotten easier to use, it's possible to do an animated feature for less and less money. And even though this is obviously a very low-budget film, everything's shaded, everything's rendered, the dog has fur, everything is lit, et cetera, et cetera. Apparently, Stubby was a real dog who got taken up by an American draftee from New England and taken to France and did all sorts of great things. He could find bodies of wounded people. He warns them of a gas attack. He catches German spies. Lassie has nothing on this dog. The problem is partially the film's limits. There are only so many times you can have a dog look up at you with an adorable, expectant expression. The dog doesn't
talk.
That's
because you're a cat person.
Exactly.
That's part of it, but yeah. it gets a little repetitious.
Oh,
it's like watching a cat sleep.
Never tire of it.
The narrator for much of it is not the dog. It's not the man who adopts him and brings him into the regiment. It's the man's older sister who's saying, I was so relieved to hear that they had made it to such and such. We never even see this character. And you wonder, why didn't they either make it from the dog's point of view or have it be the soldier's letters or something that would present this story a little more coherently? There's also, I was surprised that they refer to the Germans as Boche, which is quite insulting. And there are lots of, ethnic jokes with people making fun of the French doing things one way and Yankees doing things another. So, it's an okay minor film, but it's not anything distinguished in any way.
Is it? And it just comes out from an independent company or a company with any track record?
Apparently, it's no one that I had heard of on it.
Fun
except
Academy
the voice,
Motion Pictures.
Except, part of the voice cast, Gérard Depardieu is the Frenchman who's, of course, really a chef in real life, as I guess all the French are in films. it's...
I think Depardieu also eats quite a bit of what is concocted by the chef.
From the way he looks. Yeah. It's okay as a minor little film, but it's not something you're going to... It's going not going to stick in your memory, and you're not going to get any of the characters tattooed.
The voice cast includes Helena Bonham Carter and Logan Lerman as well. It's rated PG in wide release. Sergeant Stubby, an American Hero. Also out this week, Submergence, Wim Wenders' film. He directed it, written by Aaron Dignam. Claudia, what do you think of Submergence?
Not a whole lot. It had two very good actors in the lead, Alicia Vikander and James McAvoy. They're very attractive, and they had a nice chemistry, I thought. But the story was ponderous and at the same time kind of pointless. They tried to kind of create these forced parallels. He's a British agent under the guise of being a water engineer, and she is some kind of scientist who...
biological mathematician.
You're right, yes.
I haven't heard of that.
I know.
I was going to ask.
Yes, I was thinking oceanographer because she was going down to study the ocean floor. Yeah. So it's about they're both being submerged. He is, literally is taken captive, and that's not a spoiler. They tell you that.
In Somalia.
It's done in this flashback style in Somalia where you see what they're currently going through and then how they fell in love on the beach near Normandy. It's a beautiful place. It's beautifully shot, as you would expect.
Apparently uninhabited B&B in Normandy that they have the run of.
At Christmas time, yes.
Yeah, on the beach.
So I liked their moments. There's sort of romantic moments. It was kind of sweeping and old-fashioned. Yeah. And then when they try to create this sort of parallel, it kind of lost me.
Yeah, it's, it's directed by Wim Wenders,
right,
who has made some incredibly great movies, and, American Friend for me is a true masterpiece.
Paris, Texas,
yeah. Wings,
Wings
of Desire.
He's
done a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
But not in a long time, and, I think his last film was never even distributed. He he shows some flashes of what he can do in this film also, mm-hmm. in the scenes that you described, Claudia, with the two of them. The romance, I think, is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, you know, they're going to have to separate. He's in one part of the world, she's in another. He can't even tell her what he does for a living, et cetera, is all, you know, touching. But this idea of cross-cutting between, you know, her going into the depths of the sea and, you know, exploring life at the bottom where it's so dark you can't see it, and him being tortured
by the darkest
by the
side
darkest
of
the dark it's a dumb parallel.
It's dumb
and forced.
And it's
not even a metaphor. It's actually happening.
Yeah.
And it's too explicit and just not resonant enough.
Yes.
All right. The film is Submergent, starring Alicia Vikander, James McAvoy, Wim Wenders directed, Aaron Dignam is the screenwriter. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in West Los Angeles. Submergent is the film. Actually, Music Hall, I think, is Beverly Hills. My apologies. Yes.
One quick thing. There's a scene where the two of them visit a World War II bunker. On the beach.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same bunker that Agnes Varda photographed in Faces Places. It would have been very funny if, you know, they're having this romance.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Agnes Varda walks
off
to the
my
beach.
Film.
Right. You know, get out of the way.
I rented this bunker.
Our next film is the thriller An Ordinary Man, starring Ben Kingsley, Hera Hilmar, and Peter Serafinowicz. It's written and directed by Brad Silberling. Peter?
Well, Ben Kingsley is pretty good in this, as you might imagine. He's very good at playing. He's a war criminal and former general. He's only known in the movie as the general, a Serbian who was part of the war crimes in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. And he's been hiding in various safe houses ever since in Belgrade. There's a driver who takes him around. The premise is that he's in this one safe house in this woman who apparently is his maid is there to take care of him and look after him, but in fact she's more than that. And the problem with the movie is that I guess you're supposed to feel like at some point this character is going to show some kind of a soul, some kind of humanity, some recognizable empathy for what he did, for who he is. He's very cocky. He goes out in public, and a lot of the people who still subscribe to his nationalistic fervor, recognize him and give him sort of, you know, silent waves. But he doesn't really change a whole lot in the film. And when he finally does in the end in a big cemetery scene and so forth, it doesn't really ring true because it seems like it's sort of cooked up to make you feel more empathy for this character than is really existing in the film itself. But Kingsley is strong and, you know, he's very good at playing nasty guys with mustaches. And I've heard this from several people who have worked on films with him. He has to be called Sir Ben on the movies.
He demands that?
Contractually. Mm. Which works for these characters.
Helps keep him in character. An Ordinary Man is the thriller starring Ben Kingsley, written and directed by Brad Silberling. It's rated R, and you can see it at the Arclight in Hollywood. The Rider is based on the story of rising rodeo circuit star Brady Jandrew. It also co-stars, in addition to Jandrew, his sister Lily and their father Tim Jandrew. The movie's written and directed by Chloe Zhou. What'd you think of it, Claudia?
Well, I thought this was a fascinating exploration of this daredevil mentality, this sort of extreme masculinity in this rodeo world, and something we haven't seen very much of. And I love the way she used real people and drew these pretty strong performances out of them. And she kind of feels like she's maybe going to be inheriting the mantle from Terrence Malick and some of those panoramic scenes that looked a little bit like they could be almost Remington scenes.
Early comprehensible Terrence Malick.
Right. You know? Yes, early Terrence Malick. So I think she's a real wonderful filmmaker in the, you know, this is her second film, but I mean, I expect great things from her. There were aspects of this that I really appreciated the performances. And I felt that she had an affection for her subjects, and there was a graciousness, so I appreciated that.
Very, very clearly. I got very impatient with this movie because it is beautifully shot, but a lot of it doesn't make sense. In one sequence, somebody comes and tells Brady that his father is 4 months behind in payments on the trailer that they live in, and they're going to confiscate it. And so the father sells his beloved horse. You never hear what happens to the money, and then a couple of scenes later, the father is giving him money to go and buy another horse.
There's not a lot of story.
No, and another point, he's complaining that his father is wasting all their money in the slot machines, but then he's in the bar next to him playing a slot machine himself. It's very pretty, and I agree that the performances are, at least of, I liked Brady, I found him very sympathetic, if not always terribly bright, when doing things like pulling the staples out of his scalp where they put his head back together after being thrown by either a bronco or a bull, I forget which.
Yeah, that's the first scene in the
fucking
movie.
Bronco. Yeah.
It's set in the Lakota Sioux Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and that's where her the director's previous film also used locations. So there is a certain verity and naturalistic,
almost a documentary feel at times.
Very documentary style. And of course, since most of the actors are essentially playing
themselves.
There's one character, the lead's best friend who was paralyzed in a bronco accident.
In the movie. In real life, he was paralyzed in a car accident, I read. But
okay.
But
he can't communicate in the film except through hand gestures and so forth.
I think they really are friends because they have a really nice chemistry between them, very believable. He also has a sister who is autistic and
developmentally disabled.
Well, I thought she was, but I read that she was on the Asperger spectrum. But yes, in any case, it's his real sister. And so they also have a real working chemistry. And I like the way it sort of explored the idea of letting go of your dreams. This was his dream. And realistically, he's had this head injury. He can't go back to it. But he doesn't have a high school education. He doesn't have even a GED. So what are his options?
What I found impatient, though, he's clearly so good working with the paralyzed friend with the autistic sister and the horses. Why doesn't somebody say, we're going to send you back to school, you can become like a physical therapist?
Because there's nobody to say that. That's exactly the point, I think, of the movie, is that you're living in this poverty-stricken place where their opportunities don't present themselves and there's nobody to do that. And
the best scene in the movie, I thought, was a sort of extended sequence where there's this horse that can't be tamed, and they bring him over to see. It sounds like a cliche, but the way it's done is for real. And it's done in a series of transitions, and it's really beautiful to watch how the closeness that he has with this horse and the way that he finally makes him his friend, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, he's like a real horse whisperer.
There's also a brief, very powerful scene where he can no longer ride, but he's well known in the community for being a great rider. And so he's stocking shelves in a supermarket, and some fans, see him, and he feels humiliated.
He's like a little local celebrity.
Local celebrity, and there he is.
And he's a member of the Lakota Sioux tribe.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
It's got to be very hard to play oneself. I would think in a lot of ways be easier to play someone who's not you, because
when you
play yourself, your tendency would be to do how you do things in everyday life, doesn't work on
you. It'll be George Clooney in the Larry Mantle story.
Yeah, there you go. great choice, George.
The best example of that, I think, Larry, is what, I always say, Muhammad Ali, there's probably no one who had more charisma than he did or was more of a performer.
Right.
But he played himself in the movie, the greatest, and he was bad at playing himself. He needed, to be someone else, to be himself.
Yeah, although he probably could have been an actor in other characters.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking about the movie The Rider, which is written and directed by Chloe Zhou. Brady Jandrew stars with members of his family in the cast as well as he plays himself, but it is a drama, rated R, the Landmark Theater in West L.A. Coming up, a film which tells the story of controversial evangelist Carlton Pearson. We'll be back right after this update. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with our critics, Peter Rayner, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. The drama Come Sunday tells the story of controversial evangelist Carlton Pearson. Joshua Marston directed, Marcus Hinchey wrote the screenplay, and Chiwetel Ejiofor stars as Pearson in the film. Peter, what'd you think?
I sort of like this movie. I think Ejiofor gives a strong performance. It's unusual to see a religious themed movie that isn't either high key Holy Roller or Elmer Gantry, and so this film I think sort of is a comfortable middle ground for a very controversial. The controversy is that he has this He's a Pentecostal bishop who decides to his mixed race congregation, very popular, that you know, that you don't have to be saved in order to you know, go to heaven. That there is no such thing as hell, and you know, all very controversial stuff.
Especially in Oklahoma, where he's based.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
so,
and there was a time when people were burned at the stake for preaching that.
Well, and if I recall, and maybe I get this wrong, but I thought he was sort of a protege of Oral Roberts.
He was. And Oral Roberts is played by Martin Sheen.
Oh, wow.
Really good performance.
Yeah, that's good casting.
It is good.
And the thing is, when Martin Sheen shows up as Oral Roberts, I thought, well, now it's going to be a hit job. But it wasn't. I thought everybody in this movie is given their due, including those who are the most antagonistic towards him. There's the scene with Martin Sheen where he describes Oral Roberts had a son who was gay, who killed himself. And there's a scene where Oral Roberts talks about that and how much it grieved him to feel that his son, you know, was going to hell. And you know, I mean, it gets into some complicated areas without condescension.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to see Jason Segel in a serious role.
Yeah.
Because he plays one of the more kind of hardline.
He wants
Christians.
To do that now. He said, you know, he played David Foster Wallace in a movie.
True,
he's
and he was
he's
wonderful.
Going in the other direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that this is the rare film about an evangelical church that's comes from outside of those faith-based channels. And it isn't judging. It isn't condescending. It's respectful. And I thought the performance by Chiwetel Ejiofor was really strong. I mean, he has such a rich oratorical style, and then his vocal command is great. I think at one point he sings, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, at the end,
and he's really good. He really disappears into the role.
And Lakeith Stanfield
is
terrific.
Yes.
He plays a sort of music director who's going
tortured.
Through his torture
yeah.
because he's gay, and Danny Glover has a small role as the preacher's uncle.
Has a really good cast.
Really, it's a really good cast. I saw the film at the Directors Guild with many of the people present, including Pearson. Was there and Ira Glass this American
that's right.
Life?
It came from that.
Came from a segment in 2005 on the show. So it's worth seeing.
I mean, I like the way that it explores sort of the mystery of faith and how you could reinterpret the Bible in different ways. Yeah.
Public Radio's inspired quite a few films, and I count the Film Week will at some point, and you'll all play yourselves.
The Film Week, the
just
movie,
just like in the writer.
That's right, and Zach
right.
Let's not get into that.
Come Sunday, the story of evangelist Carlton Pearson, Chiwetel Ejiofor stars Joshua Marston, the director. It's unrated and it's streaming now on Netflix. See, some of the festivals won't do Netflix, but we'll do it here on Film Week. Aardvark, a drama that's written and directed by Brian Schoaf. Stars Zachary Quinto, Jeremy Slate, and John Hamm. Jenny Slate and John Hamm. Claudia?
I actually like this film.
The John other Hamm movie.
Yes, the other Hamm movie. It's getting a little hammy around here now. He popped up in a surprise, actually, role. Zachary Quinto also was in another film, I think, that we saw this. Oh, no, he wasn't. Never mind. Anyway, it's an interesting, quirky indie film. Zach Quinto plays this troubled soul. We don't know exactly what is wrong, what his mental malady is, but he's going to the psychotherapist who's played by Jenny Slate. She's actually a licensed clinical social worker. And then there's John Hamm enters a scene. I won't give too much away because it's kind of got some interesting little twists and turns. But it's a little small movie with kind of nice, subtle performances. And it mocks the sort of TV world because John Hamm plays a TV actor with a gift for being utterly unrecognizable, which is kind of funny to have John Hamm playing that role because he is so recognizable. But yeah, it's a slight movie, but it's good.
All right. And from a first-time director, Brian Schoaf, who wrote and directed it, Aardvark is rated PG-13. And by the way, Zachary Quinto will participate in a Q&A after the 7:20 showings of Aardvark at Pasadena Lemley Playhouse Theater. That's on a Friday night, and Saturday night at the Monica Film Center in Santa Monica, the Saturday moderated by actor-producer Matt Bomer. The movie is Aardvark. Also out this week, a 4K digital restoration of the 1967 film Belle du Jour, the Buñuel film that stars Catherine Deneuve. Peter?
Well, Larry, if you're like me and you saw this film when you were a teenager, you may have very fervid memories of this movie. Yeah, it's a pretty terrific film. I mean, some people think it's the most erotic movie ever made. I wouldn't go that far. But you know, Buñuel was the great Spanish surrealist who had a season towards the end of his career where he made films in France with his frequent writing collaborator Jean-Claude Carrière in this film. And Deneuve plays a housewife who's sort of unhappily married to a handsome doctor, but has these illicit liaisons in the afternoon where she plays, Belle du Jour is her name for being a prostitute in this house of sin. Madame Anaïs is the woman who sort of runs the show there. Catherine Deneuve. You know, there's all sorts of weird surrealistic things going on in this movie. There's a lot of sort of vaguely S&M stuff that happens. It could be very pulpy and 50 Shades of Grey. Is it 50?
It's 50.
Yeah.
Counting.
You know, but because, and counting.
Yeah.
But it has some phenomenal, Michelle Piccoli is in it playing one of the Johns, and he has all steel teeth, and she falls in love with him. And all of the scenes with this leather jacketed guy are just really kind of, you know, creepy Buñuel vintage stuff. And there's one scene that people still talk about with a Japanese client, and a rotund Japanese client who comes in and has a little box that he opens it up, and you hear a sort of buzzing sound in it. And then they do their thing, but you never find out what's in the box.
What's there? Yeah.
And if you go on the internet to this day, you know, what
it's
was
like
in that box?
Debate. Yeah. Yeah.
Buñuel never told.
And did you see it in the restoration if
yes.
you had a chance?
Yeah. I mean, it looked great then. It looks great now. The colors are very, you know, florid and over the top. The reds especially, it's all very patterned and carefully worked out visually, which is not always the case with Buñuel. He tended to be a little lax technically because he just, I guess, didn't care.
Unless well, he did with Salvador Dalí, yes.
Yeah, that was very, careful.
Yes.
Come on. I can't think of Buñuel without thinking
Me too,
of
that's
that
all I can
cringe
think of.
Movie
yeah.
Scene.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a real lie.
But who wouldn't want to look at Catherine Deneuve in 4K?
Yes.
Belle du Jour is the film from 1967. The New Art Theater is showing the new 4K digital restoration, and the film is rated R. Also want to invite you to join us for our Film Week screening series. The next movie we're showing, The Graduate, 50 years old. We'll be showing it at the theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, Saturday night, June 2nd. We invite you to join us, 7 o'clock. Tickets are available at kpecc.org/in-person. I'll have very special guests who'll be with us for the post-film conversation. I invite you to get your tickets early because tickets go fast, and these are reserved seats. So if you want some of the best seats, now is the time to get it by going to kpecc.org/in-person. I, for one, have never seen The Graduate on the big screen.
Really?
Mm. I only have seen it on television.
And you
right.
think it's
Me
in
too.
Black and white, too.
Yeah, right. Edited for TV.
Well, they're showing, you know, this wonderful TCM festival that's coming up in a few weeks is kicking off with the producers, the original Mel Brooks film, which I've only seen on TV in black and white.
Yeah.
Apparently it's in color.
Yes, who knew? Zero Mostello. All right.
The comb-over is in color.
more movies to talk about. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, along with critics Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon, and Peter Rayner. Our next movie up is the drama 20 Weeks. It's written and directed by Lena Pendarkar. Claudia, what'd you think?
I like this film. Her Lena Pendarkar's own pregnancy troubles kind of inspired this film. And one of the things that I love about smaller independent films that they're able to touch on subjects that the studios wouldn't want to touch. And this is one of those. It's kind of about the pre-parent stage, but it's about, it raises ethical questions about what goes on. We've made such strides prenatally, and what goes on if you find out that there is a problem with your fetus and how you deal with that. Also, you know, kind of parenthood being thrust upon this couple, but what happens when something goes wrong during a pregnancy and you are faced with an ethical dilemma? And it's, you know, it's not a film about abortion, pro or con, but it's a film about how you deal with this issue. And I haven't seen a film like that before that I can think of. And it's emotionally tense, and she tells it in a way that it's kind of fragmented in time. So you see the happy moments in their relationship as they're getting to know each other, and then you go into, and it flashes forward to the pregnancy, and it's well acted. Amir Arison and Anna Margaret Holliman do a good job. It's an engrossing, well-told story about an intriguing subject.
20 Weeks is the name of the film. It's unrated at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Flock of Four, a comedy directed by Gregory Caruso, who co-wrote it with Michael Nader. Peter?
Yeah, this is sort of a sort of comedy. These four guys, one night in 1959 from Pasadena, end up going to South Central because one of the kids in particular is a big fan of jazz. His father, who's passed away, was in a jazz group and idolized this one jazz artist named Pope Dixon, who it turns out is playing in Central Avenue in the great jazz clubs that they had in those days, sort of the waning years of those days. And so that's the reason for this trip. That boy's older brother thinks this is all a bad idea, four white kids going into this area, and tries to pull them out. It's, you know, there's a lot of American Graffiti-ish stuff going on in here, a lot of diner. The director is quite young, even this is his second feature, and he's done some shorts as well. And I think, you know, it's a great subject for a movie. I don't think that it really takes off in the way that it should. There are two things about it that I think were strong. The actor who plays Pope Dixon, the great old jazz artist that he's trying to hook up with, they finally do see him, but they don't get to hear him play, but he's in a bar. And there's a very strong scene between the kid and the actor, Reg Cathy, who plays Pope Dixon, who passed away. The film is dedicated to him, where the kid says to him, you know, is it possible to be a great artist without suffering? And Dixon says, well, it's an irrelevant question, kid, because jazz is dying anyway. And there's another scene where one of the younger black kids in Central Avenue in a club scene is angry at the white kids for co-opting jazz. You know, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff. Interesting stuff rummaging around in this movie. It doesn't quite make it.
Flock of Four is the film. It's unrated, and it's in selected theaters. This Is Home, a refugee story, a documentary about four Syrian families trying to get to the United States. Alexandra Shiva is the director. Claudia?
I think Alexandra Shiva does a nice job here. She's kind of an obtrusive style. It's more observational in that style of documentary, where she kind of lets the camera go, and you see these families who are refugees who have come to Baltimore, and the kind of what they go through in building their new lives and assimilating and learning the language. The children, of course, are quicker to do that than the adults. And it is an overtly political, but of course the subject matter is political. And so she kind of lets the politics of the situation kind of come through in a natural way. The experience feels very immersive, how the families cope with all the cultural differences. And also how the refugees are treated by other people in the community, both the people that are working to help them integrate and the others who just, they come into contact with, for good or ill. It's generally, I think it's a good film. It was at Sundance, and I believe it did win the Audience Award at Sundance Film Festival.
This is Home, a Refugee Story. The documentary's Unrated, Lemley's Music Hall, Beverly Hills. And the drama Where is Kira, which is set in Brooklyn, New York, stars Michelle Pfeiffer and Kiefer Sutherland. Andrew Dosumu is the director, and Darcy Peacolt is the screenwriter. Claudia?
This film. Pfeiffer, I thought, was good in it, but it never evolved for me. And she just, her character just went into this dark hole and never really came back out.
Yeah, she's a character who I think is essentially, she's sort of a quasi-homeless person, and they're trying to make it a case for sort of feminist victimhood, mm-hmm. whereas I think, she's just a little bit off the rails. It is nice that Michelle Pfeiffer is, in theory, doing films that are small, that aren't like multi-budget stuff. But she's such a great actress. I loved her in Mother, okay? I said it. just think of Dangerous Liaisons, Baker Boys, Russia House, Married to the Mob, all those wonderful performances.
And she's good in this. Given. It's just that the story is so painfully long
she's good
and
it's
bleak
but it's,
and numbing.
It's
a dull slog. Yeah.
Whereas Kira is at selected theaters and it's unrated. Speaking of jazz, I wanted to mention a documentary on the great long-past Savoy Ballroom in Harlem is being screened this Sunday at the Montalban Theater in Hollywood. It's being presented by both the L.A. Jazz Society and the Ricardo Montalban Foundation, The Savoy King, Chick Webb, and the Music That Changed America. And it also features the voices of numerous stars, people like John Legend and Janis Jackson, others, giving actual words of the jazz artists of that era. We have a link for ticket information on the Film Week page, kpecc.org. Also wanted to mention the Film Noir Festivals, the 20th annual L.A. Festival of Film Noir, which is going to be at the Cinematheque and at the Aero Theater. And some great films here. We got The Blue Dahlia and I Love Trouble as a double feature, Kiss Me Deadly and City of Fear, The Prowler, M, and The Big Night at the Egyptian Theater. So some terrific films, Peter.
Yeah, they're all, and some of these films are not available on DVD or streaming. And the prints are often really terrific. Some real finds here. There's a film noir with Tom Tryon. Remember him?
Yeah, yes. The Robe.
Yeah. Right.
He went on to be a successful novelist.
Yes,
that's
he
right.
Did.
Yeah. But he's in a film noir with the star of House on Haunted Hill. Richard Fleischer is a film noir of his. There's a lot of really good stuff. I love film noir, and it seems like there's an endless amount of film noirs that seem to always crop up. They made hundreds of them.
And so much of it is connected with L.A., too. I love that.
Yeah. I actually said, I was incorrect, they're all at the Egyptian Theater of the American Cinematheque, all of the film noirs films. Yeah. All right, for our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon for Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC, and I hope you join us for our 50th anniversary screening of The Graduate Theater at Ace Hotel downtown, Saturday night, June 2nd. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. Have a great weekend.